I'm Naiba Baranga.
And I'm Emma Dessau.
And welcome to this week's episode of Match Volume.
This is our very first episode of the new year, and we are excited to kick it off with a new season of impactful interviews.
So who's starting us off this week?
This week we have a hometown hero. We've got someone from our very own Annenberg School of Communication and Journalism, Dr. Alyssa Richardson.
She has a lot to share about the intersection of journalism, activism, and race, and her story is incredible to hear.
I think you're going to enjoy this episode.
Cool, let's jump right into it.
Will you just start off by telling us a little bit about who you are and what you do?
Sure. My name is Alyssa Richardson, and I teach journalism here at Annenberg. I specialize in marginalized communications. So that means anybody who's making journalism right now who hasn't felt heard, who is using technology to their advantage to create their own news outlet. That's what I'm particularly interested in.
What role do you think journalism can play in important advocacy issues, and specifically with marginalized communities?
I think journalism has an incredible job to do right now in terms of advocacy. I think we can no longer separate social justice and journalism. And so I think journalism is under siege, as we all know. A lot of folks right now don't trust us. There's been some recent surveys that say only 41% of Americans trust journalism. And that's not just because of these fake news or any kind of names that we're called, you know, these days. It's also because marginalized communities have not seen themselves historically in the news reports. Either they've been labeled problem people or the face of a particular societal issue, but never the solution.
What barriers do you see specifically surrounding youth and maybe marginalized communities with journalism?
Yeah, one of the things I found that was most disturbing about the rise of smartphone journalism is also this parallel movement to shut it down. I just did an article with Vogue magazine, Teen Vogue, and a lot of the activists who were featured in that Teen Vogue article spoke of being followed by private vigilantes, state-sponsored actors, all kinds of things. And to me, that's the most chilling, because if you're saying that we have a First Amendment right to look, and a First Amendment right to report what it is that we see, but yet that's not matching up with what's in practice right now in terms of people being followed or otherwise intimidated, it can really chill a movement.
What role do you think privacy and protection of privacy in the digital spaces needs to play in protecting journalists?
I definitely think there could be a better job of protecting these kinds of journalists who are in these spaces, especially women. There's been a ton of studies that show women are increasingly targeted on these sites and looked at as folks who should be doxxed or personal information should be leaked about them. They're harassed disproportionately in terms of male journalists. And so there's a lot of work to be done into protecting journalists who are reporting on these things.
And you have a forthcoming book on this topic.
Yeah, it's called Bearing Witness While Black, African Americans, Smartphones, and the New Protest Journalism. And it's on Oxford University Press, and it comes out May 1st. And it really explores the period between 2014 and 2018, where we were really seeing this resurgence in citizen journalism by way of smartphone. And I say resurgence because the Black Lives Matter movement really wasn't the first time someone aimed their camera at police brutality. That actually goes all the way back to 1991 here in LA, where we had a citizen who was in the wrong place at the right time to film Rodney King's beating. And so it really follows the trajectory of what happens when we have these witnesses who come forward and very bravely so kind of share with us what they saw. And what I found is that this is a historical kind of practice where African Americans, ever since they got here in 1619, have really been sounding the alarm on any kind of social injustice using journalism. We always hear about the civil rights movement, for instance. We hear marches, we hear speeches, but I don't think there's been enough emphasis on the journalism that's been created in those spaces.
How did you find your way into journalism?
I found my way into journalism after fighting it for a very long time. So my mom will tell you that when I was 5, I wrote this book called Betty Goes to the Zoo while she was on the phone. And she was my very first publisher because she stapled that book unbeknownst to me. And just seeing that book bound, it looked so official to me. I was like, do people actually write books for a living? Do they get paid to do this? And my dad is a first-generation immigrant here from Grenada, and he said writing is a hobby, and so you need to have something to fall back on. And so it was very much a you can be a doctor, lawyer, or engineer kind of deal. And so I said, sure, I'll pick doctor. That seems very interesting, and I love kids. And so I will be a pediatrician. And so I engaged fully in all the pre-med stuff. So I spent many of my summers at Howard University Med School in a biochem kind of lab. I took the MCAT, got into the med school of my dreams, which was my parents' alma mater, was Howard University, and decided I didn't want to go.
Dr. Richardson took a detour and applied to Northwestern's Medill School of Journalism.
And the rest is history from there. I really fell in love with journalism and just really perfecting that craft. Because even though I was on the school newspaper at my undergrad, it was nothing like having a daily beat and having to turn something around every day that made me say, oh, this is hard. This is no longer just like the story I'm going to do once a month because I'm interested in something on campus and I can get free passes somewhere. This is like a profession.
What was it like navigating that uncertainty but diving headfirst into a new grad school? It sounds like a totally different direction.
Yeah, it's definitely different because med school is planned out for you. So your next 10 years beyond college are planned. With journalism, not so much. And I was watching a lot of news organizations that I thought I would work for crumble. In 2004, right when I left grad school, is when Google had its big IPO announcement. So Google was still relatively new. And so I'm watching all these things happen in terms of Facebook open up to the public and Twitter came along a few years later. And all of us as journalists are scrambling and trying to figure out what the heck is going on. What do we do? Are we still going to have a job? And then there's very real layoffs going on, 400 people at a time. And so it's very scary to then still say, I'm going to stay with this and I'm going to stick in there and report on the things that I'm passionate about and really hope for the best. And I think that's what a lot of journalists may be facing even now.
I asked Dr. Richardson to tell me a little bit about mobile journalism, or Mojo as she calls it, and how it got its start.
One of my friends worked at a college in Maryland called Morgan State University, and she said, I'm leaving. You know, would you like to come and be an adjunct? And I was like, I've never taught before, but it sounds really cool. And Morgan State is a historically black college. It's one of the most respected colleges on the East Coast, and they didn't yet have a journalism school, and they didn't have a lot of money. And so they were trying to experiment with new ways to launch this journalism school. And a lot of my students were afraid to go out and report in Baltimore because of the crimes that were occurring in some of the areas around the school. Students were, you know, robbed at gunpoint, things like that. And they said, how are we going to go out with a big camera and report on something? Someone's going to take that from me. Mm-hmm. And so I said, what if our cameras are smaller, you know? And so we started experimenting with cell phones in 2010, because that was the first year that the iPhone had a front and rear-facing camera. And also joked that that's the year the selfie was born. So we started doing our stand-ups using the cell phones. And I created what was called the Mojo Lab, Mobile Journalism Lab. And it was great fun because during that time we were like, wow, we can really make news with something that's in our pockets. And that project really took us around the world. I took students to South Africa, to Morocco, and we were just really replicating and honing this process of telling stories with just a phone.
Can you talk a little bit about your work abroad with the Mojo Lab and just with mobile journalism in general?
Absolutely. I think that was one of the first times that I saw that mobile journalism could lower that barrier of entry for marginalized communities. So whereas before we may have needed a satellite truck and fancy cameras to get broadcast journalism out, this was the first time where I was really seeing just a cell phone really light up someone's face. And the first place that we went was South Africa, which was just a generation out of apartheid. And so the city was so excited there in Soweto, where we were. And they were just really looking forward to seeing what these phones could do. And I think one of my favorite students, you're not allowed to have favorites, but one of my favorite students is a student who has since passed. And I should mention that the program that we created there was around a grant that helped students who identified as HIV positive tell their stories. And so I had a student named Lorato who was HIV positive. She was only 15 when the program began. So she was born with it. And she loved Mojo. She would always say, oh, Miss Alyssa, I love Mojo. It's magic. And she would be like hunched over her phone editing in the van and would have her pieces cut by the time we got back to the library. Like, that's how dedicated she was. Everyone else would be kind of playing on the bus or in the van, and Lorado would be hunched over her device, just glowing in her face, just smiling. I just think that it's transformational what can happen when you put the right tools into hands that have never held them before. It just means so much to me to continue to open doors for others, continue to pass the mic. We're not, like, you know, speaking for them. We're letting them do their own speaking. Just pass the mic to them. They have their own things to say. So young people, for that reason, will always hold a special place in my heart because they have no fear. They're not jaded at all. They're not cynical. And they're open to change. And they believe very actively that they can be the ones to do it.
As someone kind of further down the path of life and who's made career shifts and learned how to do things, even write a book, you know, learned how to do new things, what would you say to students that are worried they're too late to try something new?
That's a great question. I would say to students that you're never too late. I think that this generation, though, has a keen awareness of what peer groups are doing and what others are doing in terms of social media. And I didn't have that in college. So I would say tune out what you see on social media, because a lot of it is just a highlight reel. It's really not the bloopers of people's lives. And you haven't seen their working out their mistakes and all that other stuff before the shiny project gets up there. I think you can really hinder yourself waiting on perfection, because a lot of times we think, if it's not perfect, I don't want to put it out because I'm going to be embarrassed or somebody's going to drag me on social media, and we don't do it.
What's one piece of wisdom that you've been carrying with you lately or that you've carried with you throughout your journey?
One piece of wisdom I think I would always carry with me is to just be kind to people, because there's so many folks who will encounter you in different places or phases of your life, and you'll never know how they'll come back to help you or you them. There'll always be people who will look out for you and will always make sure that you have a place somewhere if you're kind.
Thank you so much for your time. That was my interview with Professor Alyssa Richardson. If you enjoyed this episode, make sure to check out her new book, which is due in May. And in the meantime, hit subscribe to get easy access to new episodes every week.
Match Volume is a production by Annenberg Media through USC's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism. I'm Naib Alvarenga.
I'm Emma Dessau.
Thanks for listening.